Hey, hey, sex fans, welcome back. Today is Wednesday, September 5th, 2012, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
I want you all to know how happy I am right now. Being here with you people has helped me more than you can know.
That's so good to know. Well, we're all back, safe and sound from our late summer vacation. Although I must say, I think I could, given half a chance, easily get used to all that leisure. But there's no rest for the wicked, don't you know? Which is pretty okay with me because I like being wicked almost as much as I enjoy the leisure. Besides, I have another very interesting sex wisdom show for you today. I welcome the celebrated author of The God Virus and Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. My guest is Dr. Daryl Ray, and he's a psychologist that has been in practice for 35 years. Now, curiously enough, he once planned on becoming a minister, but then that plan changed rather dramatically, and he's here to tell us how and why. You won't want to miss this discussion.
Just to be clear, we're not making out. That would be social suicide.
I think I can live with that restriction. Daryl invites you to visit him on his site, recoveringfromreligion.org. You can find his books at ipcpress.com. And of course, he's on Facebook and Twitter too. So look for all these links in today's podcast posting on drdicksexadvice.com. Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up the How-To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Video Library tab in the header.
Or, as always, were you hiding behind your sense of humor instead of engaging in a real way?
Oh, I can engage in a real way, don't you know? The Video Library is the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and oh-so-informative videos right from the comfort of your own home. And remember, a portion of the money you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, comes back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So, knock yourself out! Okay, on with the show. Holy cow, Daryl Ray, welcome to drdicksexadvice.com, and thank you for taking this time to share your sex wisdom with us. You've been on my must-have as a guest list for a while now. So now that you're here, would you like to say hello to all the nice people?
Well, glad to be on here, Richard, and looking forward to this talk, and hello to your audience.
Yay. So like I said, I've been dying to get a piece of you ever since you sent me a copy of your latest book, Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. And when I read that you were once deeply involved in ministry before your sudden break with it in 1990, I knew I had to pick your brain.
Well, it wasn't so sudden, actually.
Oh, is that okay, good. All right.
It took a few years. You know, I had to go through the super liberal phase.
Yes, there's a club for that, and I'm the president, but you could be the secretary. So apparently there were several similarities between your life journey and mine. I was a Catholic priest for 20 years, although most of that time I was being punished for my views on human sexuality. And finally, in 1993, my priesthood and ministry came crashing to a halt when my religious community dumped me. Now, no longer am I not a Catholic. I don't even consider myself a Christian. That sounds familiar, I'll bet.
Absolutely. Sounds very similar. You're only 3 years off of my track.
There you go. Yeah. So, while I no longer have religion, I do have a deep spirituality, which, curiously enough, is not connected with any God or divine being. Are you a spiritual person despite your rejection of traditional religion?
Well, I stay far away from the whole word spiritual.
I see. I think good. Okay.
It's so easily confused with supernatural.
Oh, that's so true.
And the idea of an independent soul, I see no evidence for anything supernatural, including the notion that soul is somehow independent of our brain and mental processes.
Right.
So I just stay away from it.
Okay.
I don't care if other people call themselves that. It's just not an area I'm going to endorse.
Right. So I've talked with several guests who have preceded you on this show about the rift between spirituality and sexuality, and we've all lamented this fundamental disconnect, and we've all pointed our fingers at organized religion, particularly the three Mosaic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as the culprits behind this sad affair. Do you share our conclusions?
Well, actually, I would go broader than that,
because
I would include Hinduism, I'd include Buddhism, I would include any of the major religions on the planet. They all do the same thing.
Right.
So I'm a equal opportunity
negator.
prejudice.
I love it. So let's talk about how religion distorts sexuality, and let's start at the beginning. Chapter one of your book begins with this epigraph: "Religion has the power to interfere with sex before it even gets started. This distorts sexuality and sexual expression and causes sexual dysfunction and acting out behavior in many religious people, including leaders." That's so insightful. Could you expand on that a bit, and could you give us examples of how religion causes sexual dysfunction and acting out behavior, particularly among religious leaders?
Well, you know, when you ask someone to do something unnatural, then it's going to distort their behavior.
Good for you. Okay.
And that's what I see. When you tell people I cannot masturbate, then something's, that sexual energy is going to go somewhere.
Yes.
You enforce unnatural celibacy on nuns and priests, that sexual energy is going to go somewhere.
Uh-huh.
So what it oftentimes leads to is self-hate and the hatred of others. And we see that expressed in, I mean, the religious history is just replete with so-called saints who persecute other people for their sexuality and hate themselves for their own sexuality.
Whether it's
St. Francis or Mother Teresa, whether it's St. Paul or Jesus, so-called Jesus himself. So if you, and all of these characters hate their own sexuality, and as a result, they project that hate onto those around them, and it causes incredible stress. I mean, when you're told, you know, you can only breathe. Let's just say I tell you, you can only breathe 20 times per minute, period, for the rest of your life. It's going to cause a heck of a lot of stress.
It's true.
You could probably do it. You could probably breathe 20 times a minute, except of course when you're asleep, you'd have to really focus hard to make it. And there's Buddhists that can do that, I'm sure. There's people that have trained themselves how to do it.
Right.
But it's going to cause a lot of stress because it's unnatural.
Right.
And that's what we're doing with our bodies. There's enormous amounts of hormones. I mean, those hormones from very early on in your life are telling your body to do certain things. And then you say, no, I'm not going to do that. Right. That ain't going to work too well. Tell a 13-year-old boy not to masturbate. that's what Mormons are doing.
Yeah.
And you see these Mormon elders giving boys, and as you saw in my book, I actually quote a good deal of the Mormon pamphlet they give to every 12-year-old boy. It says, don't tamper with the factory.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you cannot masturbate or you're going to damage your marriage. You're going to damage your sex life. You're going to damage your spiritual life. That is just crazy. There's no 12-year-old boy on the planet, hardly, that can avoid mastery. And by the way, there's spiritually 12-year-old girls can avoid. The girls get off scot-free in the Bible and everywhere
else.
It's
true enough, is it not? Absolutely. It's amazing when you stop to think about it. Of course, they get it terrible in terms of the double standard in terms of sexual expression and marriage and, you know, being subject to their husbands, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
you mentioned leaders, and what we see if you look at it from a leadership perspective, don't you know, don't follow who you are sexually, then you get a Ted Haggard out there screwing up a male prostitute.
Right.
You know, or you get a man who's you know, who's having sex with women he shouldn't be having sex with, you know, a choir director, the preacher's having sex with a choir director. And I, as I say in Sex and God, that happened in my church so many times. And the preacher usually gets off scot-free.
Yes. You know,
the woman doesn't necessarily, but
absolutely.
I saw a preacher have three different affairs over a 10-year time period.
Right.
And they finally fired him on the third. Well, now, how many other affairs did he not get caught in? That's what I want.
You point out something really quite remarkable that I think we should address, and you said that religion's goal is to propagate religion, and I couldn't agree more. Anyone who has been in the ministerial saddle, so to speak, can certainly know that. Sadly, most lay people think that the goal of religion is to bring us closer to God, and I think they're so missing the boat on that.
Yeah. Well, I think As I talk about it in my previous book, The God Virus, which we don't need to go into that, but the focus is to procreate, but not biological procreation. It's procreation of this virus that's in our brain, or you can call it a parasite that's in our brain, and it wants to get from my brain to my children's brain, and from my brain to people. You know.
Yeah.
Like I say, when the Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your door, they're trying to sneeze on you. As well as the Mormons.
It's so true. It's true.
They're trying to give you their virus, their parasite.
Right. You list the toxic trio of key beliefs. One, belief in an afterlife. Two, belief in a voyeuristic, all-knowing God that determines our status in the afterlife. And three, belief in that this God dictates a specific kind of sexual behavior to the exclusion of all others as a condition for entry into that afterlife. So let's address each of these in turn, because I think these are very, very important. Why is belief in an afterlife toxic, particularly in terms of sexuality?
Well, not the first two are not particularly toxic until you add the third one.
Right, exactly that.
Chemical concoction. You can add sugar to Coke, but when you add cyanide, then you get... that's kind of what's going on here. You've got this sweet afterlife where you're going to go to heaven and you're going to play harps and have all this beautiful stuff happen to you. You know, you could believe in that and there wouldn't be any problem. Unless, of course, you add the negative side that you're going to go to hell, but that comes... Later. The second is you have to have a God that knows what you're doing. You know, if the God doesn't know you're masturbating at midnight or that you're having sex with your girlfriend before you got married, or you're fantasizing about some woman you saw or some man you saw today, if the God can't get inside your head and read your mind, then you can get away with murder, literally, in some cases, for sure. You got to add that third one, that there's this God dictates what you're going to do. The God in number two, the voyeuristic God, might just like watching you masturbate.
Yes, but that's a little off-putting, wouldn't you say? I mean, that's like Big Daddy in the sky. It's like because
Daddy up there that likes to watch you have sex.
Right, and you know, we have been all socialized into thinking that you know, sex is a very private sort of thing that you do, you know, not in the company of others necessarily, and so yeah, it can be very off-putting. I certainly have seen plenty of that in my own private practice, and you know, when I was in the ministerial saddle, I used to hear it in confession all the time. So.
Oh yeah, you know, I kind of envy you as a priest. You got to hear the inside track on some things.
It was disturbing on so many levels. Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
Well, I used to practice as a clinical psychologist, as you do now. You know, we get to hear a lot of stuff, but I think it's priests are more interesting.
Right.
But
I was just going to say that this daddy in the sky who is watching is often a real boner killer.
Yeah. Well, it could well be, but he also has to dictate what kinds of sex are right and wrong.
Yes.
So you could have a belief in the afterlife, you can believe in a voyeuristic God, and neither one of those is going to kill your sex life. It's that third one that says, oh, and by the way, you're going to hell if you do this, or this kind of A, B, or C kinds of sex. Only D kinds of sex or E kinds of sex are permittable.
Yeah.
And what I noticed in my research was, and we all can see this if you just look at it, is every religion has its own unique sexual pattern. So you see that certain kinds of sexual activities are verboten in the Catholic Church, but the Lutherans really don't care. Or the Hindus are all for certain kinds of sex, but the Buddhists think it's wrong. But you've got there's no one pattern that's universal to all these religions. Now, there's a lot of overlap, don't get me wrong. But whether you masturbate or not is not a big deal to a Unitarian or to an Episcopalian or even to a Lutheran. But it's a big deal to a Mormon, and it's a big deal to a Catholic.
Right. And it's curious that even those who are doing only the right kind of sex can still get in trouble with Big Daddy if you do it with the wrong person or at the wrong time or even in the wrong position.
And well, to add one more, even without the right mindset.
Oh, that is so true.
If you're screwing your wife or your husband and thinking about the hot next door neighbor, man or woman,
if you're lusting in your mind.
Yeah, if you're lusting in your own mind while you're, you know, screwing your husband or your wife, then you're in trouble because this God's watching that. He knows. He knows what's going on inside your head. If you're thinking about the, you know, the hot guy that shows up to clean your pool every Wednesday morning, and while you're in bed with your husband, that's a sin because it's in the New Testament. You can't lust after other people. Of course, it says men can't lust after women.
Yeah.
It doesn't ever say anything about women lusting after men.
So, that's only because women don't have a sexuality. That's the way it is, basically.
Well, that's true. at least the Virgin Mary didn't, evidently, among other things.
Right. So before we continue our discussion, and I'm really enjoying this, could I ask you to give us a thumbnail biographical sketch? Tell us lots of interesting things about you. Maybe a little something about your personal journey to who you are today.
Well, my personal journey started, I could say, probably when I was 12 years old and got really interested in sex. It might have been 11 years old. It's hard to tell back then. And, you know, those wet dreams just were awfully compelling. My mother caught me one day as I was masturbating, and I was all embarrassed about it. But she was pretty open-minded, and she said, well, don't worry about it. It's all right. You won't
Is
do
that
it.
Right? How nice.
Yeah. But then she went on to say, you won't do it when you get married.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Important information needs to be shared.
Yeah. But that was, you know, it was, my mom was way ahead of her time.
I guess so.
Yeah. Even though she was a fundamentalist, and so was my dad.
Oh, my goodness.
That one area of life they seemed to be pretty open about. So, and they both died within the last 7 or 8 years, but especially my mom was pretty open.
Right.
But so I was just fascinated with sex from very early on, and my mom took me to the library, and I checked out all the books that only adults could check out.
Yes.
And read these books, and, you know, not one of those books told me anything. They were all clinical in their orientation, and what I really wanted to read was Kinsey, the Kinsey Report.
Yes, really interesting.
My mom thought Kinsey was a communist, so we didn't get to read. And my grandmother would have disowned us all if she knew we were reading a communist.
There you go.
But as I went through puberty and as I went through the dating world and I was starting to have sex, and, you know, I had an early sex partner in high school and just felt guilty as hell about having sex with her, but also just compelled. What I noticed was she was non-religious. This is kind of interesting. My first sex partner was non-religious. And she was not guilty at all about it. She was all gung-ho. She was ready to go. And here I am just racked with guilt about having sex. Of course, I'm having a lot of fun with it.
At the same time, mind you.
At the same time. So here I have this dissonance. Here's this wonderful girl who loves the sex we're doing, and here's me who's going through all this crazy stuff as a result of my religion. So that dissonance stayed with me, and it really did. It stayed with me all my life until I finally figured out. I showed up. I was I went through my 2 years master's degree in religion. My undergraduate was anthropology, sociology. So I've always been interested in anthropology of human sexuality. And even did my senior thesis on Havasupai Indians in the bottom of the Grand
Canyon. No kidding. Interesting.
Spent a week studying them, talking to them, listening to them. I could tell you story after story there. But what I did understand was it was a matriarchal society. It was the women were in control of the sexual relationships. This all before, of course, contact with the West.
Right.
It was my first exposure, face-to-face exposure to a culture that had an entirely different sexuality than the one I'd been raised in.
Mm-hmm.
Started making me wonder, well, maybe there's more to human sexuality than this. And of course, then the joy of sex came out and some other things. And I went on to get my master's in religion, thinking I was going to be a minister. Well, after 2 years of studying all that crap, I realized I couldn't believe any of it.
Right.
I couldn't tell anybody else to believe it.
Especially since you had been exposed to all this other stuff, anthropologically speaking, anyhow.
Yeah, my biggest mistake was studying anthropology.
And that, interestingly enough, in my training, it was seminary, seminary, seminary all the time. And so I wasn't really exposed to anything other than the party line. And so by the time I was ordained, they had formed me. They had made me. They, kept out of my reach. And I was unimpressed by, all this other stuff that I later discovered and realized that, had you shared this information with me, I would have never taken that path.
Exactly, yeah. Well, information control is really important to religions.
Absolutely.
Because they can't infect you properly if you're out there getting information that contradicts the party line, for sure. So I went through all that and ended up in psychology and working on my doctorate, and that time I got exposed to Albert Ellis. Well, that'll cure about anybody of religion. First time I heard Albert Ellis, I was just blown away that a man could be so open about sex, and sexuality.
Yeah.
And that really put the two areas together, psychology and sexuality.
Yeah.
I just had to bring the religion in. When I wrote Sex and God, I was doing the research on it, and I was shocked that Albert Ellis wrote a book, a pamphlet, if you will, back in the early 70s about religion and guilt. But nobody's really written about sexuality and religion, except, of course, the Christians and Muslims. I mean, all those religions write books about what it's like to be a Christian, have Christian sexuality.
Right.
But
that's moral theology. That's not human sexuality. And that was the problem that I would run into continually. When I was doing my doctoral thesis in clinical sexology, it's just that, the church is talking theology as opposed to sexuality or biology or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's why I call it Christian sexuality.
Yes.
Or Mormon sexuality or Muslim sexuality.
Right,
it is not human sexuality.
Right.
The two aren't actually related in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
The big reason why I motivated to write the book, because I wanted to show people, look, what you've been taught is Christian sexuality or Mormon sexuality. It is not human sexuality.
Right. That's interesting. Very good
and
point.
Let's look at human sexuality and then come back and contrast that with what you were taught.
Right.
So, whether you're religious or not, because you're living in this culture, you're getting infected with a bunch of just ideas.
Yes, it's hard, impossible to be unaffected, it seems to me. Some people can inoculate themselves from a virulent strain of it, but I just don't think anyone can actually get off scot-free. So do you consider yourself an atheist these days? And if so, could you define that for us?
Well, it's pretty simple. My view is there's no supernaturals of any kind. I'm an atheist about Zeus. I'm an atheist about Yahweh. I'm an atheist about Allah. So, I just don't think any of them hold any water. But atheism is not an organizing principle. I don't.
Well, I see that, from time to time. And, this is one of the reasons that I don't identify myself as that. I don't know what to call myself, actually. I'm way past agnosticism. But, atheism, it seems to me, at least from the views that I get of it from the media, is, it's a form of religion. It's often as angry and hostile and exclusive as fundamental Christianity.
Well, I consider myself a humanist.
Good for you. That makes sense to me.
Most humanists are atheists as well.
Right.
Atheist only says I don't have any beliefs in any right. supernatural beings right. out there. That's all it says.
Right.
And beyond that, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. You really ought to look at what are the positive values that you want to live by.
Right. As opposed to the negation. You know, that's
right.
It's, you know, when things are defined by what they're not, then they're, you know, I think we're off on the wrong foot.
Yeah, I don't consider myself an anti-Santa Clausist. And so atheists, you know, atheists sometimes can come off like that, but
right.
I'm not. There just isn't a Santa Claus. There just right. isn't a Yahweh. There isn't yeah. a Zeus. There's not an Allah.
Yeah.
So that's the most I want to say about it. I don't
yeah.
need to say anymore.
Right.
That's all you can say,
right.
actually.
Exactly. So
yeah.
let's get back to your book then. And you talk about sexual maps in Chapter 2. And Chapter 2's title is You Can Take Religion Out of Sex, But You Can't Take Sex Out of Religion. What do you mean by sexual maps? And can you give us an example of one such map?
Well, I wanted to create a metaphor that the reader could identify with.
Right.
And we all have maps. We've got maps in our back seats. We've got them on our GPS. and anymore, you know, we don't use the paper and maps anymore. But so we all have related to maps. Inside of our bodies is a map. It's a DNA map about mm-hmm. who you are. And it's gonna develop based upon this instruction set that the DNA map you're given. Now, that DNA map could have an X and a Y chromosome, or it could have two X chromosomes. You know, that's going to make you tend towards being a male or a female. But I use the word tend.
Yes, I do. Good for you. Thank you for adding that. That's wonderful,
yeah,
by the way.
Because it's a whole spectrum. And I think this binary dichotomy that religion forces on us between mm-hmm. male and female is totally a cultural construct.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religious construct, specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And our culture is bought into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are cultures out there that don't force people that deeply into a male-female mindset. Now, they're pretty rare cultures, and they never became dominant cultures. But there are, you know, there are cultures that recognize that men and women are not just all masculine and all feminine.
Right.
And I wanted to point that out as a sexual map. You have a DNA map. Then there's another map that comes in on top of that. And that's the map that the epigenetics that it's just starting to really be understood here in the last 10 years or so. How are your genes influenced by the environment the genes are developing in?
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, it's it's in utero. You know, is the mother smoking? Is the mother drinking alcohol? Is the mother under a lot of stress? And we found that a lot of these external influences actually impact the sexuality.
No kidding. That's interesting. Yes.
For example, the rat experiments to show if the female rat is under a lot of stress, her hormonal responses to the stress will demasculinize the baby, the fetal males inside of her.
Mm-hmm.
Fetal males will actually come out acting more like females when they're born. So we have clear evidence that the mother herself has some impact. We also know that the statistics are showing that the more boy children a mother has, the more likely the boy is going to be is going to be homosexual.
Right.
So if a mother has three, four, or five boys, the fourth or fifth boy has got a much higher probability of being homosexual than the first boy did. And again, it seems to be the mother's response to the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
That's map number two. It's laid on top of the genes, but it's still inside the mother in many ways. And then map number three is the social, the psychological, the environment you're born into, the culture.
Right.
And those maps are trying to push things on you as well. And they can also have a huge influence on you. And here's something I think you could speak directly to. I'm kind of curious about your answer. Is that third map is being formed very powerfully when you're in puberty, when your
right.
hormones are just starting to flow. And what I've noticed, I talk about this a bit in the book, is I had priests come to me. They drove a long ways to come to me and talk about their sexual issues. Two different Catholic priests over a short period of time, within a year. And I'm listening to these two Catholic priests express to me, oh, I've got a porn addiction, I've got a masturbation addiction, I've got a sex addiction. And as they describe this to me, Richard, it just sounds like normal 13-year-old.
It's so true. I've talked about this. I've written about it. It's in my book, Secrecy, Sophistry, and Gay Sex in the Catholic Church. It's precisely that. I mean, these men were arrested in their sexual development as early pubescent boys, and they find themselves in a sexual awakening in their 40s or 50s or sometimes earlier, and they're who they were when their sexuality was arrested, and that was it. You know that, they're trying to make sense of an adult sexual world with the mores and the capacities of an early teenage boy. It's tragic.
Truly is tragic. Development. It's right. Arrested development, to use a popular term, I guess.
Yes, right.
Nuns, I'm sure it's true of nuns, too. I had quite a bit of contact with nuns off and on, but over a longer period of time and not nearly as, not in the clinical setting.
Yes.
I'm thinking it's probably true on that side as well.
A quick story. When I was doing my doctoral thesis on the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests in the active ministry back in 1981, when it was published, just before then I was servicing a convent of nuns, liturgically, I mean, and that's what we used to call it, servicing. But anyhow, so I was saying mass for this group of nuns, and it was their feast day, and so they were having a big to-do dinner, and a lot of the nuns from the local community came to the mother house, and we all had mass together and dinner. And at dinner, I was sitting at a table, must have been eight or nine nuns at the table, and one of them asked me what I was doing, what was my ministry, and I told him my ministry was study, and I was doing this research. And they all looked at me, and they just like, oh, that's amazing. And I said, I hope at some point somebody does research about lesbian nuns. And they looked at me and they went, well, there's no such thing as lesbian nuns. and they were being like totally honest. And, I said to them, I said, so sisters, you're telling me there's no such thing as same-sex feelings and acting out and sexual expression among religious women? And they said, no, we're not saying that at all. We're just not lesbians. I went, oh, so I learned that unless you ask the right question, you're not going to get the right answer. They thought, lesbians were stompy dykes, on bikes and, mullet haircuts and plaid shirts and stuff like that. And they weren't like that, so, they weren't lesbians. It was fascinating stuff. Anyhow, I'm just looking at my clock, and I see that our time is up for today. Any chance I could get you to come back and tell us more about your book and your life experience?
Sure, let's have some more fun like this.
Yay! Excellent. So, but before we go, could you give us your website address, walk us around a little bit, and tell us where we can find your book?
Yeah, the books, you can go to ipcpress.com. That's the... And I sign all books ordered from that particular website.
And I'll have a link on that in today's podcast posting.
Okay. And you can also see it, of course, on Amazon and Good. Barnes & Noble online and all those sorts of places. I try to do a pretty regular blog about sex and sexuality as it relates to religion. I'm not into the human sexuality piece as much.
Right.
I mean, I am, but I'm more interested in how it relates to religion, and I do that on my Facebook page. So, Sex and God Facebook page. It's my book's Facebook page. So you could go on there and like it or subscribe to that page, and you'll get a regular dose of what religion does to your sex life.
So, until next week then, Daryl, we'll be visiting you in cyberspace.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. What a terrific show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next week at this time for part two of my chat with Daryl Ray and more sex advice with an edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. However, before we let you go, I want to remind you that this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How To Video Library. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous sex resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the tab that reads Video on Demand.
No, keep crying. I want you to feel this so you never make this mistake again.
Gus, you're so strict. There's no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute kind of deal. And your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty goddamn sweet, huh? And remember, a portion of the money you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, comes back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So be sure to knock yourself out. One more thing before we conclude, I want to make sure that you know about my product review site, DrDickSexToyReviews.com. That's right, sex fans. Now, it's so easy to see what's hot and what's not in the world of adult products. I and the Dr. Dick review crew review all kinds of adult-related goodies. Sex toys for sure, but also condoms, lubes, fetish gear, as well as educational and enrichment videos. Don't miss a single one. Again, look for DrDickSexToyReviews.com. You'll be so glad you did. All right, until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.